Welcome to Hidden Gems Toronto, the podcast that introduces you to a variety of fascinating people and places that fly under the radar but are a vital part of our city's fabric. I'm your host, urban geographer Tom Scanlon, and I invite you to don your virtual hiking boots and join us as we track down these compelling stories.
I believe in birds. I believe in their beauty, in their wisdom. I love the way they take me out of myself and enable me to live anew. I marvel at their capacity for flight, their sense of direction, their straightforward life stripped down to the basics. Eat, choose a mate, breed, protect. I gather that they don't think too much. They don't have writer's block. They don't sit around wondering what project to take on next. They don't worry about authenticity or presenting their best selves on social media. I love birds because their lives are nothing like mine, because my anxieties would not only seem inane to them, but would register as a foreign language.
The voice you just heard is Julia Zarankin reading an excerpt from her best-selling book, Field Notes from an Unintentional Birder. A few years ago, before the pandemic, I was driving in a van with my brothers on our annual baseball trip. At one point, we were making idle conversation when one of my brothers casually mentioned he went birdwatching on a recent holiday. There was silence for a moment, and I was waiting for someone to pounce and say something like, "Isn't that a bit of a nerdy activity?" Instead, another brother spoke up and said he too had done some birdwatching recently on a trip to Costa Rica. And then I piped in that I had just returned from Colombia, where one of the highlights was doing a birdwatching tour with a guide. So that got me thinking, if the Scanlon boys are into birdwatching, or birding as you will learn in this podcast, who else is doing this? Well, the answer is a lot of people. In fact, birdwatching is the fastest growing hobby in North America. More Canadians spend time birdwatching than they do gardening, and a lot of people like to garden. And it's not just a hobby for old timers. Half of the birders are under the age of 50. In this podcast, you will meet Julia Zarankin. At the age of 35, during a stressful time in her life, she began searching for a new hobby and decided to give birding a try. She approached it with the same passion and enthusiasm she has for everything she undertakes. So much so that she decided to write a book about her experience. We caught up with Julia just as she was preparing for her favorite month of the year, May, when the migratory birds come back to Ontario shores. The podcast is called Flying Above the Radar. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, Julia, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Terrific. Before we get into our discussion about your passion for birds and the intriguing book you wrote, your bio shows you are one busy person. Maybe you could tell us about the things you do when you're not out looking for birds.
Thank you for doing your research, Tom. So when I'm not looking for birds, I am a lecturer to lifelong learners, and I give lectures about avant-garde art movements, about Russian literature, about Russian history, and I also work with high school students as a writing coach, high school students who are applying to university. I am also very, very interested in Yiddish, and I have just been awarded a Yiddish translation fellowship. So I'm now working on translating a Yiddish book from Yiddish into English, and it is a memoir about a woman's experience in Stalin's gulag in the 1940s. So yeah, a little bit heavy, but fascinating stuff. So that's kind of a bit of what I do. And I'm also a writer, of course.
I wasn't kidding when I said you're busy, Julia. I know growing up, you weren't that interested in birds, but is it accurate to say you sort of had a midlife crisis and you were looking for a new hobby or sport? You have a great line in your book where you say you wanted something that would exercise your patience without having to do yoga. I laughed out loud at that line. How did you decide birding was for you?
That's exactly it. I was having a little bit of a midlife crisis. And I decided birding was for me when I read an essay by Jonathan Franzen called My Bird Problem. And this essay that he published in The New Yorker is about how birds essentially made him a less cynical person. They made him fall in love with nature in a whole new way. And at the end of that essay, I thought, oh my God, maybe this will be the answer to all my life problems. Maybe I need a bird problem of my own. And so when I went out and found a bird group, I knew nothing. I had no idea what I was getting into.
So what was that first experience like with the birding group?
It was very strange. I signed up to meet these people who I had never met at 6 a.m. in a parking lot. And they all arrived wearing bird t-shirts and, you know, baseball caps with birds on. I didn't even have binoculars. But if there is one thing that I immediately realized, it's that birders love beginners. They love beginners so much because there is nothing more exciting for a birder than having the chance to relive that moment of seeing a bird for the first time. These people were so welcoming. I mean, they did think I was a little bit weird, you know, for arriving without binoculars, without anything really. I mean, you know, they were shocked to see what a blank slate I was. I wasn't kidding when I said that my family didn't do the outdoors. I didn't grow up with the outdoors at all.
So you were that empty vessel just waiting to be filled. I could see how they would get onto that. One thing I've learned from you is that there are people that are termed bird watchers, and then there are the more sophisticated group called birders. For me, baseball fans like AAA versus the majors. But for you, what is the difference between a bird watcher and a birder?
Yeah, it is a distinction that people make. I wouldn't necessarily call birders more sophisticated. They are perhaps just a little bit more obsessed.
Okay.
Bird watchers are sort of a little bit more casual about the whole enterprise. Like, you know, they're the people who will go out and kind of be happy with whatever they see, right? Like the feeder watchers. Birders, on the other hand, usually have a little bit of an agenda, a checklist, and they hope to see specific species. And birders are often prone to, I think the term is twitch. They're prone to twitching. So if they see a report about a rare bird somewhere, they will probably hop in their car and drive miles and miles just to get this bird. Yeah, I would say it's a question of degrees of obsession. So, you know, depending on the day, sometimes I'm a bird watcher, sometimes I'm definitely a birder.
But is there, for most people, like a eureka moment? You sort of wake up and say, you know what? I'm now a birder. Does it happen like that?
I think the eureka moment is when you realize that you want more, more and more and more, when you realize that you're a little bit insatiable.
Looking back for you, when you started out, what was the hardest skill for a novice birder to learn?
Wonderful question. I feel like the hardest skill for me was actually learning to use my binoculars, because it's one thing to detect movement in the tree and then a totally different thing to actually find that in your field of vision in your binoculars. So that's actually a challenging skill to master. That was really hard. Another thing that was really hard is there is this whole family of sparrows that are basically little brown birds, and birders call them LBJ, little brown jobs. And they all, to an untrained eye, they all look identical. And that was really, really hard not to get demoralized by that. And another hard thing is that birds change their plumage. Even migratory birds that are super colorful in the spring, like the males are just drop dead gorgeous, super, super colorful. But in the fall, they're all pretty drab because they're not trying to seduce a mate. So who cares if they're not as bright and beautiful? There's a lot of challenges in birding.
What about the balancing act between recognizing a species by their sound versus trying to visually locate them? I mean, how do you interact those skills?
Oh my goodness, you are pointing to my greatest insecurity.
That wasn't my goal, Julia, but carry on.
So your previous question about the hardest thing, actually bird song is extremely challenging for me. Even though I come from a really musical family, I don't really have much of a sense of pitch. There are a lot of apps that you can use to kind of like memorize bird song, recognize bird song, and I make a lot of mistakes. But the really impressive birders and my role models are the people who know their bird song, and it just adds a whole different dimension to birding. So not only are you seeing this gorgeous thing in your binoculars, this, you know, absolutely gorgeous avian wonder, but you're also hearing it. So it becomes like a full body experience, really, when you see it and hear it and kind of know its behavior a little bit more. Birdsong is very, very challenging and also an exciting thing to learn more about because it gives you a fuller experience in the field.
I know early on in your birder career, you really identified in a personal way with migratory birds each year. I think because of your own personal family history, maybe you could elaborate on that a bit.
Absolutely. I was born in the former Soviet Union And my family emigrated to Canada when I was about 3 and a half. So I feel, in a way, I am also a migratory species, and falling in love with birds kind of helped me think through my family history a little bit, and to really see us all as these kind of eternal migrants. Because even before my family emigrated from the Soviet Union, even before that, my grandparents had been displaced because my family is Jewish. And so during the Holocaust, they were evacuated from Ukraine to the far east of Russia. And even before they were displaced in the Second World War, during the pogroms at the turn of the 20th century, they were, of course, displaced from their shtetl. So there's been a lot of wandering in my family history, a lot of migratory activity. And falling in love with birds really helped me see all of this in a new light.
Joy, this is totally off topic, but it must be difficult for you to watch what's unfolding in Russia and Ukraine.
Oh my God, it is horrible. It is beyond horrible for me right now. And it's also forced me to really rethink my own identity, because I am a Russian-speaking Jewish person from Ukraine. My whole life, I've always identified in Canada as Russian. But now I don't feel comfortable identifying as Russian, because that holds no meaning for me anymore. It's been a real process of rethinking who I am, where am I from? I was born in Kharkiv, and of course, that city is being bombed relentlessly. I feel like, in a way, my past is being, just stolen from me in a way. I was planning a trip to Ukraine with my parents this summer, and it's horrible.
Wow. Well, we hope for better days ahead. Julia, I've always associated birding with exotic places, where the walk in nature is as much fun as spotting your favorite bird. But you discovered a very strange location to find birds. Why on earth did you decide to finagle a way inside the Ashbridges Bay waste facility? Not exactly a charming location.
Sewage lagoons are amazing. It's a gold mine for birding. Tom, like you, when I first started birding, part of the attraction was I thought I would go to beautiful places. And of course, I have gone to beautiful places as well. But one of the first birding trips I went on was to a sewage lagoon. And the first thing we did is we had to buy a $10 permit. There are microorganisms in sewage lagoons, which birds adore. And it becomes a real hot spot for waterfowl and shorebirds. But back to the Ashbridges Bay water treatment plant, that was actually a very challenging place to get access to. Not everybody can go in there. We did that during our Christmas bird count, thanks to the fact that one of my team members, through one of his in-laws, cousins, sisters, brothers, I don't know what, managed to get us a permit. And so it's really extraordinarily exciting.
Wow. I guess, is it fair to say that for the avid birder, finding the bird trumps finding the perfect location?
Absolutely.
I know, Julie, you're also really intrigued with the science of birds, and that led you to volunteer at the Tommy Thompson Park Research Station. Well, you did some fine work there. Tell us what exactly you were doing.
Yeah, so I volunteer at a bird migration monitoring station, and it's right in downtown Toronto. I never even knew this place existed before I started birding. What we do is we study migratory patterns of birds. So we put up mist nets, and the birds fly into the nets. Essentially, we capture them, and then we extract them from the mist net. And then we weigh them and sex them. We check for fat, so we determine their health in a way. And all of this data gets pooled between all of the migration monitoring stations in North America. The data is extremely useful for understanding bird population patterns and also just in the health of our migratory birds. So it's absolutely, absolutely fascinating.
What an experience. And further to that, if I say CBC to our listeners, I think most people think I'm referring to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, but not in your world. You mentioned it briefly earlier, but tell us what CBC is all about.
I also used to think CBC referred to the radio, but actually the CBC is the Christmas Bird Count, which is one of the oldest citizen science projects in North America. Basically, before 1900, there used to be this tradition of a Christmas bird hunt. So people would go out and hunt birds on Christmas. It was a tradition. And one of the most famous American ornithologists at the time, Frank Chapman, he said, what if we went out and left our rifles at home and just counted the birds? This became a tradition. This was also the early days of optics, so hardly anybody had binoculars. So really, to study a bird, you had to shoot it. Instead of shooting the birds, people began counting them. This is now a tradition. It is done worldwide, and it is a huge citizen science project. And again, that helps us understand bird population trends, the movement of birds, whether we're seeing, you know, less of one species, more of another. It really helps conservationists understanding climate change and where the patterns are changing. It's such a fun day. You go out at 7 a.m, you count as many birds as you can in this particular quadrant of the city, and you get to go to a sewage lagoon if you're me, and it's a wild time.
What a nice thought. We replace guns with cameras. And I'm guessing you feel like really part of a larger community on that day.
I do. Yeah. You know, it's absolutely wonderful. Most cities will have bird clubs or nature clubs. And most of these clubs organize Christmas bird counts. So it really is a moment to kind of come together and celebrate your love of birds and also to contribute to science.
Julia, you've tweaked the term BFF and you've changed it to BBF. What does that stand for? And maybe tell us a bit about the friendships they can form through these birding adventures.
Yeah, so BBF stands for Best Birding Friend. I have a number of BBFs. It's really interesting, the friendships that can form. Well, I guess it's like this with any hobby. So when people are intensely interested in something, bonds form. And it's fascinating. I've met people from all walks of life birding and just had extraordinary conversations with people who I probably would not have met otherwise. And it has been so wonderful since my book has been published, just the support that I've received from the birding community. It really is a community. And of course, like any community, there's a little bit of politics. You know, I've met absolutely, absolutely wonderful people. And I feel like in this book, I really wanted to honor my birding friendships, because when you're out in the field looking for birds, it's always helpful to have an extra set of eyes to get help from other people, because the more people there are, the more things you're going to see. So I really wanted to honor all the other people who have been part of my birding journey and just my birding education, really.
Well, you know, one of the things I enjoyed most about your book is your insight into which birds you wish you could replicate in your own life. Maybe you could read that one paragraph where you talk about that.
It isn't scientifically right to anthropomorphize, to see yourself in a bird, connecting with birds as if they were humans. And yet, that's how I fell in love with birds and started to see them as part of my own landscape. Because after a few years of looking through binoculars, I started seeing them everywhere. And if asked who I'd most want to resemble, I'd have to say it in bird speak. I'd like a cedar waxwing's hair, a northern flicker's intrepid sense of style, a Ross's goose's superlative confidence, the mellifluous singing voice of a wood thrush, a belted kingfisher's singular blare, a winter wren's capacity to be heard, a northern gannet's fierce, single-minded determination, a black and white warbler's awesome classic elegance, and a red-winged blackbird's ability to make a first impression.
You know, Julia, I think I have a writing project for you. You should consider creating a play where you bring all these characters to life. I would attend that play.
I will consider it, Tom.
Another thing that you talk a lot about in the book is important life lessons that you've learned while birding. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. I feel like birds and birding has taught me so much. The biggest lesson I've probably learned from the process of birding is really learning how to be present and how to sort of love where you are. The most important thing about birding is really to look and observe the detail of things and to appreciate the bird for what it is instead of what you wish it were. And in a way, that has been such an important lesson in terms of my marriage and how to make my marriage more lasting. So, you know, really look at the person in front of you for who that person is rather than who you wish that person was. That lesson I've gotten from birding. Another really important lesson that I feel birds have taught me is that birds are really the antidote to smugness. Because when you're birding, the minute you think you know something, you will essentially be proven wrong. So birding is a lesson in humility, constant humility, and also a lesson in befriending failure. I used to be so afraid of failing, right? So afraid of misidentifying something. But really, the only way to improve is through constant misidentification. And then you finally figure out the right way of seeing something. Misidentification is nothing to be afraid of. Failure is nothing to be afraid of.
That's fabulous insights, Julie. I like that. Another aspect of birding, this is a bit different, but it seems to me if you're a birder, you are naturally a conservationist and environmentalist. Unless, of course, you go running off paths in wetland areas and trample precious grounds just to get that perfect shot. But it makes me wonder if maybe birding should be part of our climate change curriculum in schools.
I really think it should, because for me, I didn't start off being a conservationist. I really didn't know that much about it, but by falling in love with birds, you know, suddenly there was this thing I loved. And the next step after that is like, oh my God, I want to protect it. I think when you love something, you want to help those birds thrive. That love is really the first step to conservation. Right now, there are so many things to be depressed about in terms of climate change and the trajectory that our poor planet is on. But I feel like if you start from a place of love and hope, then it's easier to get more people on board and more people to care about this. So I would totally agree. You know, when I volunteer at the banding station, we get groups of kids coming in quite a bit. And just Wonderful. To see those children's eyes light up when they see a migratory songbird in the hand, it's like nothing else. Those are the kids. That is the future of our planet and the future of conservationism also.
Another lesson about staying close to home, I guess, after a dozen years of birding, you came to the conclusion that maybe you don't have to be part of a big group and drive all over Ontario. Toronto's a haven for 350 bird species, and sometimes the great opportunities in your backyard, right?
Absolutely. And that is something that the pandemic really made me reconsider. It's interesting because before I started birding, I just assumed that in order to see nature, you had to travel far. I was so shocked to realize how much we have right here in the city. Like really, all you have to do is look. And I think that is the point that the pandemic really brought home to a lot of people. Everybody is, especially in the early days of the pandemic, everybody was spending their time looking at their feeders and just marveling at, oh my God, there's so much beauty right here. So yeah, definitely.
But even before the pandemic, we were seeing a huge increase in birding. What do you think accounts for this surge?
I think several things. First of all, technology, definitely like different apps that help you identify birds. None of this existed 10 years ago. So in a way, it has made it a little bit more accessible and possibly also more appealing to millennials and teenagers and kind of the younger generation. So I think technology has had a huge, huge impact. And programs like eBird, which is a citizen science database, eBird enables you to get kind of competitive with people and to see where you fall in terms of like the ranking and the top 100. So people like that a lot. I think that accounts for a rise in popularity. Also, I think people are noticing with their busy lifestyle that being outdoors is helpful to their mental health, really.
You mentioned technology. Do some of the older birders frown on that and say, the old days were better. We just had our little book and our binoculars. Or are they all in too?
You know, I feel like people are all in. You know, sometimes I frown at the technology aspect because I feel like it gives me FOMO, fear of missing out. And it makes me a little too manic because I'm constantly checking reports. So every so often, I have to delete a few apps from my phone because I feel like it's preventing me from really enjoying what I'm looking at. But no, I think even the older generation is pretty excited.
So let's say our listeners have drank the Kool-Aid, Julia, and they're intrigued with the whole experience. What are your tips for getting started? I mean, do I go by the book, the binoculars? Do I need my vest with the pockets and my tilly hat? Or what should I do first if I want to become a birder?
Oh my God, you mentioned the vest.
Sorry, I had to.
Make that the last thing you buy. Well, yeah, you read my book, so you know this. Actually, I owned a tilly hat since I was 16. Like, I had a tilly hat before I even saw my first bird.
Okay, you started with the hat.
I would say get a pair of binoculars. Binoculars don't have to be fancy. You could spend $5,000 on binoculars, but I would say get a pair of binoculars that feels good to you. If you're really just starting out, you can get a pair for like $50 at Canadian Tire. And just start looking around your neighborhood. Don't focus on the brown birds because that will just depress you. Focus on little blasts of color that you see. Look at a cardinal through your binoculars. It will be miraculous. It'll be this moment that you'll never, never forget. Binoculars are great. I would say if you have a smartphone, which probably most people do, download Merlin, which is an extraordinary app developed by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And it is such a helpful tool in terms of identifying what you see. And now they've really perfected Merlin. You can like record the song the bird makes, and it will tell you with reasonable accuracy what that bird is. So I would say those two things, an app like Merlin, and a pair of binoculars. And I love field guides. I adore them. I like them more than the apps. I would recommend David Sibley's Field Guide to the Birds of Eastern North America.
Great recommendations. Julia, I know May is your favorite birding month. You know, the birds are coming back home. It's kind of like March Madness for college basketball fans. You talk in the book about how fabulous Point Pelee is for seeing that, but what about here in Toronto? Can you give us a few suggestions where we should go birding this month in Toronto?
Yes. Tommy Thompson Park is an extraordinary place. So Leslie Street Spit, it sort of has two names. It's at the foot of Leslie and Lake Ontario. That is an amazing natural oasis in Toronto, this piece of urban wilderness. That's a great place. Anywhere along the ravines is a wonderful place during spring migration. Colonel Sam Smith Park, so where Kipling Avenue meets Lake Ontario, that is another super hot spot. There are so many great parks in Toronto. Cemeteries are usually really great places to bird because they have old trees, really anywhere along the lake. That's been one of the most surprising things to me is that when I fell in love with birds, Toronto really transformed from this kind of concrete jungle into a network of interconnected wildernesses. So we're so lucky to have so much green space in this city.
Fabulous. You know, Julia, I'm guessing our listeners are wondering, have you kept a record of all your sightings? And if so, do you have a count of how many birds you can say you've seen?
Yes, I do keep a record of my sightings. It's called, well, in birdie language, it's called the life list. And that's another reason why eBird is such a popular citizen science app, because it enables you to keep track of your life list. I used to just have this journal where I wrote down all the birds, but now eBird keeps track of it for me. And I think I'm at, 485.
Yowzo.
But you know what? That's nothing. There's 10,000 birds in the world.
So you got a ways to go, Julia, but I can see you getting there. We always end the podcast with this question. What do you like most about living in Toronto? And you're not allowed to say birdie.
Oh my God. So many things I love about Toronto. Oh, and I can't say birds. I would say music. Music and dance. Oh, you know what I forgot to mention? I am also an adult ballerina. So I'm a lifelong student of adult ballet. I love the ballet scene in Toronto. Getting to see the National Ballet is one of my favorite things to do. I adore classical music, so going to the opera, the symphony, concerts, live theater, live performing arts are my favorite thing about Toronto. Our art scene is extraordinary.
And, you know, I'm going to give you a free plug because Julia wrote a great piece for CBC. It's in the first person. If you go online under CBC first person, and she talks about this ballerina experience. It's a great piece, so. It's been a real treat talking with you today, Julia. We're going to put a link to your book and to your website on our Hidden Gems site. I have to tell you, this book is just a great read. Whether you are a bird watcher, a birder, none of the above, you're going to like this book. It's called Field Notes from an Unintentional Birder by our guest, Julia Zarankin. Julia, just thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
On our next podcast, airing June 1st, we tackle the issue of food waste and food production from a slightly different angle. Julia Germania works for a charity known as Not Far From the Tree. This creative organization has figured a way to not only salvage huge quantities of fruit that grow in our backyards, but has created a program that shares that fruit with people in need. We also chat with Mike Galley, who decided he would create a planter box where he could grow his own fruit and vegetables. Then he started to make more for others who liked what he had created. Well, that little project grew in leaps and bounds. So far, Mike and his cohorts have produced more than 400 boxes to share with others. And what does Mike charge for these gems? Absolutely nothing. These two passionate people share their stories with us next month. I think you will really enjoy it. As always, the Hidden Gems Toronto podcast is produced and edited by Sharon Scanlon. And just a reminder, you can enjoy all our past episodes on our site, hiddengemstoronto.net. Thanks for listening.